Right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are holding remote hearings pursuant to House Rule 10.01. And Anna, would you please go forward with the roll?
Chair Becker Fenn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feiss.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for being on time. We do have a quorum. Today, we'll be hearing a couple more presentations, but we do need to move the minutes from Tuesday. Representative Feiss, do I have a motion to approve the minutes from January 19th, 2021?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Feiss moves approval of the minutes for January 19th. Any discussion? All right, hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. And with that, we'll get right to the presentations. Members, first up, we have the Guardian Ad Litem Board. If you could go ahead and identify yourself for the record, welcome to our committee.
Good morning. I'm just trying to find my, I seem to have lost my camera. Oh, goodness.
There you go.
Here we are.
All right. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and the organization that you're with.
My name is Tammy Baker Olson. I am with the Guardian State Guardian Litem Program. I'm just trying to find my screen. My apologies. Am I back here? Can you see my screen?
We can see your screen, but it looks like it's a little bit of a split screen where we can see your notes on the side. Okay, we'll give you another minute to figure it out. Even if we were in real life, it usually does take a couple minutes to get everything rolling.
Rachel had helped me so that the screen shared on the one. Is Rachel, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Do you know what I'm doing wrong so that my screen doesn't show both?
I think you have to choose which screen. If you have multiple screens, it should give you an option of which screen to share.
Okay.
So it should pop up and you can choose the one that just has the PowerPoint. If not, what I can do it.
Ms. Baker Olson, why don't you go ahead? We have everything was emailed to members, and in the meantime, I know that Rachel will be working diligently to figure this out. But if you want to go ahead with your presentation, please introduce yourself and go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I can't see anything right now. I don't know. Oh, gosh.
Well, we see you, so...
Let me see if I can.
I don't have any screen up.
Can you see? Can you see mine now?
We do see yours. Thank you, Rachel.
I can see yours. I just don't have my notes. I'm going to try one more thing to share my screen.
Ms. Olson, can you get your screen up with notes, and then I can just go through the PowerPoint as you talk through it?
Yes.
Yeah, why don't we do that? And you'll just say next when you're ready for the next screen and slide, and I'll move it forward.
Thank you, Rachel.
Okay. So good morning. My apologies, everyone. I've been asked to present a program overview and explain the board's role in judicial proceedings. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is a board established in the judicial branch of state government. The board exists so that all children with a court-appointed GAL have their primary needs met, and that each judicial officer is equipped to make informed decisions for each child within the confines of available resources. As you will see, there are very few statutes that govern the Guardian Ad Litem Board. The first statute, the federal mandate, in 1974, Congress enacted the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, also known as CAPTA. In order for states to receive 4E federal foster care funds, the act in part requires states to enforce laws mandating the appointment of GAL on every juvenile court case where child abuse or neglect is alleged. As a result, we have our Minnesota mandate, which was enacted in 1975, 260C.163, and Minnesota Statute 518.165 includes the CAPTA language regarding mandated appointments. The GAL board was established in 2010 by Minnesota Statute 480.35. Prior to 2010, the Office of the State Court Administrator established GAL standards, which were at the time approved by Judicial Council. The State Guardian Ad Litem Board revised the standards and renamed them GAL Requirements and Guidelines in 2011. The duties and responsibilities of the board are to administer a statewide independent guardian ad litem program. The board consists of 7 appointed members charged with both mandated and permissive duties. Mandated duties require that the board approve and recommend a budget for the legislature, establish procedures for funding distribution, and establish GAL standards, policies, and procedures. As part of the permissive duties, the board may choose to propose statutory changes. The current board includes 1 retired judge, 1 retired court referee, 4 attorneys, 1 former guardian ad litem, and 1 community member. There's currently 1 very recent governor-appointed vacancy. So we've established the guardians ad litem are court-appointed advocates who are federally and state-mandated on all child protection family court cases where allegations of abuse and or neglect are present. The guardians ad litem responsibility is to advocate for the child's best interests for the duration of the court proceeding, and this is accomplished through 5 core statutorily mandated duties. It's important to note a GAL can only be appointed by a judge and is not a neutral. A guardian ad litem is an independent voice speaking solely on behalf of the child in a system with competing interests. In 2018, I want to talk about our board a little bit. In 2018, the board engaged in a realignment process and implemented a structure called policy governance. Policy governance is a way to fulfill the board's mandate to govern and is based on 10 integrated principles, resulting in better board and program accountability. Starting in 2018, the board worked diligently to define what are called executive limitations. In total, the Guardian Ad Litem Board have 11 policies, all of which include measurable goals for tracking compliance. I present each policy to the board for a review a minimum of once a year, while some are reviewed quarterly or biannually. So moving on to our program reach, we are active in all 87 counties. We currently have 227 employee guardians ad litem and 183 volunteer guardians. all of whom advocated for the best interests of over 16,500 children in 2020 in both child protection and family court proceedings. This includes nearly 800 Native American children on ICWA cases, all of whom attended over 33,000 court proceedings and filed over 18,000 court reports. As you can see, the Guardian Litem program has low operating costs. You're looking at our 18, 19, and 20 budget expenditures. Our operating costs are typically 15% of our operation, and 85% it goes directly to personnel. This slide summarizes our organizational chart, which is organized by district and division. So we have one state program administrator, two directors, eight managers, and one planning specialist that's a part of that management team. We've got 31 coordinators who oversee 227 guardians ad litem, seven central office staff, and one staff attorney located in the 4th District. So the org chart includes total FTE by district and division. The Guardian Ad Litem program has in recent years combined the management of six of the 10 districts, resulting in financial savings as well as efficiencies. We currently have combined management and oversight in the 1st and 2nd District, the 6th and 9th, and the 7th and the 8th. You'll notice the addition of an independent family court division, which was developed in 2020 as a result of a 2017 National Center for State Courts evaluation and a 2019 Guardian Ad Litem Program Committee called the CAFC, which I'll talk about in a little bit. We also aim to develop an independent ICWA division within the Guardian Ad Litem Program in 2021, which I'll speak more about shortly. So our family court division, in 2017, the National Center for State Courts Evaluation recommended the Guardian Ad Litem Program explore an independent juvenile court, independent system, independent of juvenile court. In 2019, the Guardian Ad Litem Board formed the CAFC, which was the Family Advocacy and Family Court Committee. This committee offered up a broad plan for implementing a statewide family court division within the Guardian Ad Litem Program. The addition of the statewide family court division sought to centralize GAL appointments to standardize, train, and support more uniform family court practice. The Guardian Ad Litem Program transitioned internal resources as well as hired additional GAL in order to create the new division. This regionalized specialized division aims to improve upon family court practice statewide. I'd now like to talk about some really exciting things happening as a result of our dedicated ICWA staff and ICWA initiative. In 2020, 40 GAL and leadership staff participated in a four-day strategic plan with Indigenous Collaborations, a woman and American Indian-owned business. As a result, four committees were formed, one of which is the ICWA Division Committee. The group was charged with and have since made their recommendations for an independent ICWA division within the Guardian Ad Litem Program. Leadership is in the process of researching the data and identifying the resources needed to develop this new division. The program goals and objectives are to promote equitable systems change that will positively impact children, Indian children and families, expand upon the service delivery model dedicated to preserving American Indian children and families and culture, and establish representative, culturally sensitive, and knowledgeable staffing that assures efficacy in ICWA case management across Minnesota. The main objective of a dedicated ICWA division is further to be ICWA GAL availability in every district with centralized, culturally informed, consistent oversight. We aim for a proportionate number of Native American GAL in leadership positions and that 90% of cases are serviced by Native American guardians ad litem. So this transitions nicely into our program's race equity work. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is committed to addressing racial disparities within the child protection system and the role the Guardian Ad Litem Program plays concerning those disparities. Through this work, we hope to cultivate a system and a framework of advocacy where all families and children in the state of Minnesota receive equitable outcomes concerning child protection matters. The Guardian Ad Litem Board and leadership recently have completed the intercultural developmental inventory to determine where we as individuals, land on the continuum of intercultural development, as well as we as a group. So the, both the board and our leadership have done that independently of one another. In order to move all of this work forward, the Guardian Ad Litem program recently completed an RFP concentrating on our race equity work. We're looking to partner with a race equity coach to help lead us in this work. Two of our main deliverables include a program evaluation to look at our policies and procedures with a race equity lens, as well as strategic planning. We are committed to this work, and we realize we need someone from the outside to help us reach our goals. So I'll end in talking about how GAL have performed their duties during the pandemic and what steps were taken to ensure the children of Minnesota are served while maintaining the safety of our staff. Pre-COVID, the majority of our staff were home officed, and so we were set up to work remotely for the large part, with the exception of the second and fourth districts, Ramsey and Hennepin County, and in a spattering of offices in courthouses across the state. But by and large, we were prepared. Most guardians ad litem were just prepared because of how we were doing the work, to work from home when the directive was given. In mid-March, plans began to provide further guidance during the pandemic, including a first draft of the guardian ad litem HR pandemic procedures and our COOP plan. Procedures included daily leadership, COVID conferences, conference calls, and continuing messaging program-wide. As you can see on this slide, I just gave a little bit of a snapshot for a timeline. Guardian Litem suspended all in-person visits on March 16th until CDC-approved PPE was distributed and staff were trained on its use. Leadership then introduced a phased-in model, or outlined in part below. PPE was distributed on 5/28/20 with concurrent online training and guidance, and we entered our phase, phase one, June 15th. What we didn't realize when we entered our phase one on June 15th was that we would be at this work come, you know, November. Our phase one included the expectation that office visits were safe, that they happen outdoors, and that if a safe outdoor visit could not occur, that that be a telepresence visit. As we came to the end of our summer months, we realized we had to, like the rest of the state, do some dialing back because outdoor visits weren't possible. So that's where we are right now. We do have the guardians have the ability to see high risk children in a safe setting with consultation with their coordinator and leadership. And so at this time, that ends my presentation. I'll open it up for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Baker Olson. One thing I'm guessing others might be wondering about too, but if that leads from your last slide, if you could elaborate a little bit more on what that looks like as far as how you're ensuring that children are, you know, it's really easy for a parent to be, or some other adult to be right off screen, you know, impacting the interaction that the child is having. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more, elaborate on that last slide.
Sure. So when COVID initially hit, we gave a lot of consideration to how we were going to do this work and how we were going to support guardians of light in doing the work. Telepresence was obviously came on board pretty quickly. We trained staff and staff, not unlike many of agencies across the country, caught on pretty quickly. So along with telepresence and the support and directive on how to use telepresence, we quickly came up with a plan to triage all of the children in the program. So coordinators and guardians and some managers met with each guardian ad litem and triaged the caseloads, and we ranked our cases high, medium, and low, depending on what the situation was when visits needed to be suspended. In doing that, all of that information was logged in our case management system, and then those weekly consultations with their supervisor, they determined how they were going to do the work. We obviously emphasized increased contact with the agency. You know, court reports, filing of court reports never stopped. We just were hard at work on how we can do our job and support guardians in doing the work. Telepresence, you know, is not ideal. Collateral contacts, being in contact with collateral contacts, obviously contacting your coordinator, the guardians contacting their coordinator if they had concerns that parents weren't cooperating or that parents weren't getting the support they needed. You know, we always, even pre-COVID, guardians, you know, bring cases back into court where there are concerns, where they're not able to get their work done. There isn't a clean answer to the question. It was all about triaging, supporting guardians and doing their work, and continues to be that. Constant consultation. There was a lot of gains made in collaboration with the agency. I think the agency and guardians, while there was always a lot of support and collaboration, I think there was sort of more collaboration in getting information, because, you know, how the agency was gaining their information on how families were doing and how guardians were doing that work. It was more of a collaborative effort.
Okay, thank you. We do have a question from Representative Frazier.
Representative Frazier.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I was glad to see in the presentation the pieces about developing that equal division. I think that's vitally important, and particularly in a state like Minnesota with the populations that we have. The other question I had, I see you're doing the racial equity and inclusion work. Do you have the demographic breakdowns of the GALs currently working with the department?
I do have that.
Ms. Baker Olson.
Sorry, Madam Chair, Becker Fenn. Yep. Representative Frazier, I do have that information and can provide that. I don't have it with me today, but I can certainly follow up. It's something we both track demographics of employees as well as the children and families that we're working with. And so I can certainly provide that information to the committee.
Yeah, Ms. Baker Olson, if you could send that to Rachel, we will get that sent out to members afterwards. Representative Frazier, any other questions?
No, that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next question is from Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier touched upon what I wanted to ask. I just wanted to ask that on the question of strategic planning on race and equity, can you elaborate more? Because usually when we talk about race and equity and defining outcomes, there's something that's lacking. So can you help me identify what are some things that is not meeting those, you know, race and equity needs? And, you know, what do you hope to get out from the strategic planning?
Ms. Yes. Baker Olson.
Representative Vang. Yes, we have given a lot of consideration and thought as to why we haven't been able to move the mark as a program. We've talked a lot about, you know, the fact that we as a leadership team need to be able to define what race equity is. I think the Guardian Litem program, not like and all other agencies, we put a lot of effort in awareness and in training and in attempting to retain staff. And we, not unlike other agencies, aren't making a difference in many of those areas. One of the slides mentioned we want to move from allies to accomplices. And what that means to me is, you know, while we can be supportive and be an ally, that isn't making the difference that we need to see for the families and the children we work with and quite frankly, for our staff. And so what we hope to gain by working with a race equity coach is really taking a look at, you know, making a difference. We've talked a lot as of late about our hiring pools. You know, unless we have a 50% pool of people of color, we're not making that difference. And so how do we do that? How do we go about doing that? We've made some very small preliminary steps recently that have made some pretty marked changes. We reviewed our ICWA GAL posting recently, a committee, a group, an internal group, and took a look at the wording and how the posting was worded. And it wasn't, it was very bureaucratic and worded in a way that was very off-putting. And so that group went to work and changed some language, added our ICWA mission statement that came out of our strategic planning to make it more, I think, welcoming. And so this last pool in which HR and this committee did some work around this, we saw a marked difference in the pool. And so I'm hoping that the race equity coach will help us see what we haven't seen up until this point. This is not a one and done. We are looking to commit to this work in a way that that it's sustained and sustainable. And so we're all very excited about it. I mentioned the IDI. You know, by saying that this leadership group and that the board have completed the IDI, that's just an inventory, and we know that. It did give us some, I think, some good data on where we are as a group and individually, the individual work that we have to do in order to move that mark, move us down the continuum of intercultural development. So I hope that answered the question.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. That's all.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Baker Olson. I want to go back to that last slide about the virtual visits. I find it really troubling, honestly. I've not personally worked in the guardian ad litem system, but I've had friends who have been guardian ad litems, and I know it's very difficult, challenging work. And I'm very concerned that, you know, it's very hard to assess the situation without being there in person. And we found ways to safely go to dentists and go to doctors and have other kinds of appointments in all other walks of life. So I'm just wondering if you can speak more directly to why I get initially in March when we didn't know the vaccine or I'm sorry, when we didn't know much about the virus and how it operated. But now that we really know good safety protocols and social distancing and 15 minutes and, you know, we know so much more. Can you talk about how many of those visits are still virtual? And is there a very concrete plan to move back to in-person visits? I find this very concerning. Thank you.
Ms. Baker Olson.
Madam Chair. Representative Robbins. Yes, I can speak to this. I can tell you the guardians, the program leadership share your concern. It has been just pretty recently that we did the dial back, and I can describe the moving forward work group that we have that meets regularly that has guardians ad litem on the work group management leadership. You know, we're meeting regularly in order to get back out there. We do have visits occurring where it is safe and it makes sense. We need to pay attention to not only the guardians, but the families that we work with and their comfort level as well. I can say that there, and I can get that information as far as, you know, the telepresence and visits that are occurring. We would like to get back out there again next month. But we, as other agencies, have to take guidance from the governor's orders. And so I can assure you that we have guardians are wanting to get back out there and do their job as they did pre-COVID. where there is the need and there is the concern for a visit, those visits are happening. It's the lower risk visits that we are encouraging telepresence at this time.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Ms. Baker-Olson, I would love to see the data on the breakdown of how many visits are happening in person. And I would like to see, you know, a list of any barriers that you see in the executive orders that are keeping you from doing that. And that's maybe something we can advocate for with the governor's office. But I find it, you know, very concerning that there's working groups meeting, but there's not more action happening. So please keep us updated on this. And when you can send that information, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
And Ms. Baker-Olson, again, if you could send that to Ms. Ghanani so that we can share it with the entire committee, that would be really helpful. One other thing I will note just personally with my experience with the Guardians Ad Litem system is that, you know, the difference between a low-risk case and a high-risk case when there are a lot of changing factors can, things can change really fast. And so, you know, I understand, like, we may have found ways to keep up with the paperwork to make it look like work is happening, but just really remembering at the end of the day that the goal is to keep these kids as safe as they can be. So with that, we have another question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Baker-Olson. And my question is a little bit related to Representative Robbins, and just curious as far as number of cases, new cases that have opened during this COVID time, because, of course, the great concern is these kids aren't in school. Some of those people that are required to report child abuse or other issues, you know, they're not seeing those kids. And so I'm just wondering if you've seen a decline in new cases since COVID, if it stayed about the same, and if you're expecting on the other end of this to get a rush of cases.
Ms. Baker-Olson.
Madam Chair. I'm trying to take the question in chunks here. So we did see a decrease, and depending on the district and the county within districts, we have seen decreases. That has not been across the board. Because we know CHIP filings are down, we do have less appointments, JAL appointments. So that is true. It isn't dramatic across the state. And so it does depend on the district and the county within the district that you're in. To answer that part of the question, are we concerned or is there a concern that there will be an uptick or an increase as we reopen up, so to speak? I think that's a concern that the child welfare system in general is concerned about and preparing for.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. It's also one of the reasons we talked about very early on, or probably, you know, early on about the triaging so that when we do open up, which cases are going to take priority. And to an earlier point, and I think it's a point well taken. I believe it was you, Madam Chair. These cases can change dramatically. That is why the consultation is so important. Staying on top of cases is so important. Contacting collaterals is so important. You can have a low risk case that can change quickly. So we never assume that because we've identified a child or a situation as low risk that it's going to stay that way. And guardians are well aware of that. Conversely, there's high risk kids who are doing quite well. So it isn't just about where they land on the continuum. But I think that there is a concern that when we do open up, you know, we've got to be really diligent about how we're doing the work and getting back out there and doing the work in the way in which we did it prior pre-COVID.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And So I'm just curious as to what you might be doing to prepare for that. And I mean, to the chair's point of cases changing and changing on a dime, of course, we're all concerned because the stress level in homes right now is, has been quite a bit greater than it has been in the past. And then I'm just wondering in the preparation piece, what the average caseload is per guardian. I'm sure that probably varies from your volunteers may not have as many cases as the paid people. And I'm sure it depends district by district, but if you could kind of address the caseload piece and the bandwidth, if there is a surge in cases once we get back to normal.
Ms. Baker Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the bandwidth issue, we have, it does depend on which district you're in, and both for the cases they're carrying currently and the cases that that is an average caseload in non-COVID times. Geography plays a big part in guardians' caseloads. Our 6th and 9th districts, parts of our 7th, 8th, certainly parts of our 3rd, there's a lot more distance to travel. And so it's all relative. The average caseload of a guardian at any given time pre-COVID was, is we shoot between 30 and 35. Currently, we have lower caseloads right now, and we know that that could change. We also have some districts who have a little bit of higher caseloads because of the way the work is done differently. In the metro, that is the case. And so how we're preparing, we have a number of vacancies that we're holding off on right now to see what it's going to look like as we open up. So we're prepared to staff differently should the need arise, and just keeping a finger on the pulse as far as what it's looking like opening up, what are our numbers. We have a case management system in which we're able to run data and look at numbers, look at cases, and so that's how we're preparing. We are prepared to bring on additional staff if it's warranted.
Representative Scott, any follow-up?
No, thank you for that answer, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I will say I did some quick checking here during the questions, and it's my understanding that the governor's executive orders, there's no specific order regarding guardians ad litem. And, you know, I think specifically it's if you can work from home, you should work from home. And I think that this is a case where this work I don't think can be done as well as it should be from home. So we just encourage things to move ahead faster, maybe than they are right now, given everything that's going on. And with that, we do not have any additional questions. So thank you, Ms. Baker Olson, for your presentation. I'm sure if members have questions that they think of later, they can reach out to you to try to get more answers. And members, we will share that information that was requested as soon as we have it available. So thank you, Ms. Baker Olson, and we will move on to our next presentation. So our next presentation is from the Uniform Laws Commission. I believe we have a couple different Uniform Law Commissioners here with us today. I will also note that my laptop is currently sitting on a copy of the 2008 Uniform Commercial Code. You need those big fat books to keep your laptop at a good height. So with that, welcome to the committee, and we will move ahead with the Uniform Laws Commission presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can everyone hear me? Hi. So my name is Kimberly Lowe. I'm a local lawyer here in the Twin Cities, and I'm one of your Minnesota State Uniform Law Commissioners. We'll give you a little, we provided a little overview in your materials that are posted on the CUA website. We're not going to share those because you see them all the time, but we will try to share a video, but you will have to forgive me if I can't make it work. I'll give you a little background about the Uniform Law Commissioners, but I'm also going to tell you who's also with us. One of our current commissioners, Michelle Timmons, is with us. She's down there. And one of our longstanding commissioners, Bob Tennyson, is also joining us. You should note that the state of Minnesota actually has 10 sitting uniform law commissioners. I'll get into the details a little bit later about your appointed ones versus the existing ones. So the Uniform Law Commission, I'm assuming the chair is a lawyer if she has a copy of the UCC. Those of you who are lawyers are probably familiar with the Uniform Law Commission, even if you just remember it back from when you were in law school. So the Uniform Law Commission used to be called NACUSL. And what it is, it's a 123, almost 125-year-old nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. It's a national organization. It was founded in 1892. And the objective of the Uniform Law Commission is to draft and promote uniform laws. So when there's a benefit to having laws that are uniform state by state, the Uniform Law Commission takes up that task to draft and promote those laws. The chair referred to the UCC, which is the crowning jewel, the Uniform Commercial Code. It's the crowning jewel of the ULC work, and it's been promulgated in all 50 states, and it is invaluable to our system of business in the state. So that's just an example of one of the ULC acts that we have. The ULC process really promotes the value of the states and the role the states play in their own enactment of laws and their own governance. There are commissioners that are appointed from all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So the commissioners are covered all over the United States. The ULC is funded primarily from dues that are paid by the states. The dues that are paid by the state are appropriated by the state legislature. So every year, every 2 years, we come to you and we ask for that appropriation. Commissioners themselves, like myself, Michelle Timmons, and Bob Tennyson, first of all, we all have to be licensed lawyers. So that's the one thing about the ULC, you have to be a lawyer. Most of the sitting commissioners are either practicing lawyers, professors, legislators, and other thought leaders in the legal profession. They generally serve all across the profession, but it is a requirement to have a license to practice law. I'm going to try to show you a brief video. Forgive me, we were trying to do this earlier, and I'm just learning how to share a video. That'll give you a little bit more of an oversight of the ULC. Can everyone hear the sound? Yes.
If you could just make it bigger.
The Uniform Law Commission is...
Can it be a lengthy sentence?
I'll try and keep it as short as I can.
It's a national organization.
Made up of lawyers, judges, legislators, scholars.
Hundreds upon hundreds of volunteer attorneys.
Best lawyers in the country.
From diverse backgrounds and fields. And geographic areas that
try to strike a balance.
The appropriate balance.
Between diversity and uniformity.
Where everybody has come to the table.
A lot of different interests and experienced people.
To find solutions that are not based on ideology, but are based on good government, good policy.
The nonpartisan, highly professional approach.
To solve some very significant current issues. And
attempt to draft well-crafted and well-conceived, wise, and uniform laws.
Word by word.
Line by line.
An incomparable product.
On specified subjects for which uniformity of law is considered to be beneficial.
For example,
Uniform Determination of Death Act.
Uniform Unclaimed Property Act.
The Uniform Military and Overseas Voting Act.
Uniform Probate Code.
The Environmental Covenants Act.
The Collaborative Law Act.
The Common Interest Ownership Act.
The Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act.
Adult Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Jurisdiction Act.
Uniform Anatomical Gift Act.
The Landlord-Tenant Act.
Uniform Interstate Family Support Act.
Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act.
Uniform Child Custody Enforcement Act.
Uniform Power of Attorney Act.
And, of course, one of the
signature acts of the Uniform Law Commission.
The backbone of American commerce.
The famous Uniform Commercial Code.
All of these acts
keep the vitality within the states and
benefit the people of this nation as a whole.
As a former state legislator, I can tell you from my own experience how important the work of the commission is.
was successful. I was excited. Well, that just gave us a little overview of the ULC from the ULC's perspective. The drafting process that we go through is lengthy. Typically, what will happen is someone will propose an act of some sort of act that's current to what's happening. We take 2 to 3 years to draft an act, and then it goes through a lengthy process through committees. It's looked at by the entire ULC. It takes quite a bit of time. The ULC meets as a whole. All the commissioners meet annually in the summer. We didn't meet last year, of course. We met virtually last year, much like everyone else. And at that point, all the commissioners look at the proposed legislation, and then if it's enacted, it goes to the ABA. We also have a partner with the American Bar Association. The ABA looks at that legislation. It will put its stamp on it, and then we will come back. All of us will come back to the states and try to present it to all of you as good acts that we think will work well to be promulgated in our states. Who are your uniform law commissioners? Under the Minnesota statute, we have three people that are appointed by as commissioners at this point. They're appointed by the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Automatically, the reviser of statutes is a person who is a uniform law commissioner. Michelle Timmons, who is here with us as a lifetime member, was our former reviser. Our current appointed ULC commissioners are the Speaker of the House, Melissa Hortman. She's been a ULC commissioner since 2011. Me, I've been a ULC commissioner since 2016. I kind of take up the business law bar slot that we always have for ULC commissioners. Dean Jenkins from the University of Minnesota sits as a uniform commissioner. He was appointed in 2018. And of course, our current reviser, Ryan Inman, is a uniform law commissioner. Of note, we have, as I started at the beginning, we have 10 commissioners. Our lifetime commissioners include Jack Davies, who has served since 1966. Just wrap your head around that. He's been a uniform law commissioner longer than I've been alive, and many of us have been alive. Harry Hainsworth has served since 1992. Harriet Lansing, who was an Honorable Harriet Lansing, who was in that video, she served since 1993. Bob Stein, who was a former dean of the Minnesota Law School, University of Minnesota Law School, he has served since 1973. Michael Sullivan, a business lawyer here in town, has served since 1971. Bob Tennyson, who's here on our call and is very active today, has served since 1989. Michelle Timmons has served since 1998, and Harry Walsh has served since 1971. So we have four appointed commissioners and six lifetime. It's important to understand that those lifetime commissioners bring a huge amount of value to us as a state because they are highly respected amongst the ULC, and they're able to participate in many high-level processes. The ULC is made up of all volunteers. So we all volunteer. We don't get paid for any of the work that we do. Currently in Minnesota, we have enacted 145 uniform or model acts. That places us 10%. We're at the top 10% of enactments in the country. We're considered a national leader with what we promoted as our uniform acts, and it's something that we're very proud of in this state. Currently, just to let you know what we're working on, we're in the process of introducing a couple of acts in the 2021 session. The first one is an amendment to the Uniform Athletic Agent Act. Another one is the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act, which is a very relevant act right now. Another act is the Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Canadian Protection Orders. I think someone on this call might be an author on that act. The next one is the Uniform Registration of Canadian Money Judgment Act. Then the next one is the Uniform Pretrial Release and Detention Act. That's a lot of words, but that's a bail reform act that's been in process for a long time. People are really recognizing the value of looking at the bail system. And then the Uniform Wage Garnishment Act are acts that we're currently looking at this year. Your uniform commissioners are very active. Like I said, we've had three of them serve as president of the Uniform Law Commission, which is a two-year term that's very active and very Michael Sullivan, Bob Stein, and most recently, Honorable Harriet Lansing served as president. Speaker Melissa Hortman served as the vice president. Bob Tennyson has served as ULC legislative chair for a long time. Michelle Timmons has chaired several study committees and drafting committees, and she's currently on the Cybercrime and Enactment and the Electronic Legal Materials Act. Jack Davies has served on the Uniform Pretrial Release and Detention Act, which we just talked about, the Bail Act. And I'm sitting on about seven of them right now because I'm the youngest, so I get to do the most, I think, is what happens when you're a ULC commissioner. But we also worked internationally. So the ULC does international work, such as Professor Stein has chaired the International Legal Developments Committee, And Harriet Lansing chaired the ULC delegation to the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. So with that, I'd like to either let Michelle or Bob add a little bit more about the ULC and then open it up for any questions you might have.
Stephanie, if you could just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
I'm Michelle Timmons, the former reviser of statutes. And during the 18 years I was reviser, I was automatically a uniform law commissioner. And then I was able to stay on the Uniform Law Commission and ultimately become a life member because I decided in retirement I really wanted to continue as a Uniform Law Commissioner as my volunteer work, along with also being an election judge and some other things in our community. And so just to sort of illustrate some of the things that we do, I'm chairing a new study committee on cybercrime. And how this study came about is that the National Sheriff's Association pointed out to the Uniform Law Commission that all 50 states have laws on cybercrime, but they are not consistent. And so particularly in the area of cybercrime that is national and sometimes international, some consistency would really be helpful. So now what we're going to do for the next year or so is study whether or not the Uniform Law Commission should start a drafting project on this topic. So one of the things we need to do is identify stakeholders, such as the National Association of Attorneys General, a lot of federal agencies where there might be overlap with federal law to get their input. And that's, it just, I think, helps illustrate what the Uniform Law Commission tries to do, find a topic that would, where uniformity would really be helpful to the states. Then get a group together to first study it, and then if there's a green light, then draft it. And pull together a lot of different stakeholders at the table to get input at the drafting, at the study phase, and then also at the drafting phase. So I just thought maybe using that example would help. Then, you know, when we get to the enactment phase, for example, there is the Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Canadian Protection Orders Act, which has now been introduced. Thank you, Representative Mueller. It's been introduced as House File 113, and Senator Mark Johnson has just agreed to carry the act in the Senate. So then, you know, what the Uniform Law Commissioners do is really work, again, with stakeholders here locally and with our authors here in the Minnesota legislature to provide information and promote the enactment of uniform acts that make sense for the state of Minnesota. So I hope those examples just give you some ideas of the scope of the process of the ULC.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Tennyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Tennyson. I've been a commissioner, as mentioned, since 1989. Let me add a couple of things. The drafting process for the Uniform Law Commission is quite intensive. I currently serve on the drafting committee to on the use collection use of personal data, which is of interest to everybody in the country. It's a very complicated issue. And just to illustrate, we have something like 80 observers who participate in our committee meetings. Our committee meetings are open. The information is all available to anybody who wants to participate or look at it. And we, the committees, as was mentioned, meet for 2 or 3 years. We usually meet 2 or 3 times a year in committee. It's usually a weekend, and it's with all of the commissioners, members of the ABA who participate, as well as the people we seek out as observers. Those are people who have an interest in the topic or are stakeholders and can provide a lot of information to us. So it's a very detailed process. Secondly, after we have a draft that we think is ready to be read, it's taken to the annual meeting and is read line by line and debated. And the purpose of the 300 commissioners in the audience or so is to prove to the committee that they're not as smart as they think they are, and ask a lot of probing questions and help us shape the act. We find the weaknesses in it. We try to correct those. Then we go back and work for another year or two to try to perfect it. And then we bring it back for another line-by-line reading in the whole conference. So it's very thorough, very tedious. I think it's always well drafted. We may not always have the policy right, but that's a judgment call. But anyway, it's an exciting process for some of us sit in a hotel for a weekend and argue about things. Other people may not think it's so exciting, but those are some of the things that we do. And statutorily, we're required to attend the annual meeting, and also our statutory duties are to seek enactment of the acts as we present them when we think it's appropriate for the state to do that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do have several questions. I know this is pretty nerdy territory, but also very, very important. And I think not just to attorneys. I do think it's really unique and can be really helpful as far as efficiency to have the same laws in different states. So first on the list is Representative Moeller.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Just a couple comments and then a question. I just do want to mention the Protection Order bill that was brought up. I hope we're going to hear that soon in committee, and I would love members of this committee to sign on as co-authors. Normally, I'd run around with the green jackets to all of you, but obviously that's not possible now. Also, just want to mention, if I'm not mistaken, Commissioner Tennyson, you're the person who the Tennyson warning is named after, I think. So, like, here's a little nerdy moment that's super exciting for me as a lawyer to see you here. And then my question has to do with how do you reach an agreement? You have a lot of commissioners. Is it unanimous agreement? Are there dissenting opinions? I'm just curious how that's achieved.
Whichever one of you wants to take it. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. We reach it by consensus. And unless we can reach a consensus in the committee and in the process, We make the assumption that we're not going to have a consensus sufficient to get states to adopt it. So it has to be, it has to have the kind of the acceptance, that's done through, the process, the arguments, the presentations of information. That's why one reason it takes so long, because not everybody starts out on the same page, and there's an educational process that goes through, and we go through, we find out from industry and the stakeholders what will work, what won't, so that's how we arrive at it. It's a consensus, and then just to bring that forward, when we bring an act to the floor for a final approval, it's after the second reading. It's almost unanimous by the states. Each state has one vote to approve a process, a committee report or a committee bill. And so that's how it works. And, in my 30 years on the commission, I've hardly seen any that received more than half a dozen or, two or three votes in opposition. So that's how we arrive at it.
Any follow-up, Representative Moeller? Okay. Representative Liebling.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Really, you can see the lawyers are really interested in it. I guess that's why we're lawyers. I am interested in, as you know, the legislature gets a lot of requests to join interstate compacts. And I would like to know what, if any, relationship the Uniform Laws Commission would have to that side of things. Do you consider those compacts? Do those compacts sometimes become uniform laws? Can you give us advice on those? What's the relationship, if any?
If whoever I may, wants to take it.
I'll try. We do not work on interstate compacts. We're aware of them. We're aware of what the implications sometimes when we're drafting an act. For example, we drafted an act to improve the accuracy of criminal records, and there is an interstate compact that governs many of the terms and conditions of that, so we're well aware of that. But we are not in the process of developing or promoting interstate compacts. That's not what we do.
Representative Liebling.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, but wouldn't give advice on them? You don't keep track of them? Nothing like that?
Mr. No. Tennyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, no, we don't. And that's not part of our charge. So,
Commissioner Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, you know, I'm sitting on a newly formed study committee called the Public Health Emergency Authorities Act, and that was put in place, a study committee after COVID, just to try to figure some of this stuff out. We did look at and consider all of the interstate compacts as sort of educational to our work as to what's being done, but it would not be part of what we would propose. But it depends on, there are people who are aware of them and studying them to see if they're effective with what was happening, but they're certainly not in our purview. As Commissioner Tennyson said, our job as uniform law commissioners is to really look at the state acts, the laws, and help get for uniformity. Some of the compacts kind of interplay with that a little bit, but they're definitely, that's someone else's job. Not that we're kicking the can, but our position tends to be, how do we get the best stated law that can then be enacted state by state that might accomplish something similar, but it's certainly not the end goal to use the compacts.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious about the bail bill that was approved last year, the Uniform Pretrial Release and Detention Act. And my question is, I'm curious about who participated in that drafting and whether there were any community voices that were included as that language was considered. Thank you.
I'll take that
Commissioner
one.
Commissioner Lowe? Okay.
Yeah, I'll take that one, Madam Chair. So a longtime commissioner and someone who you all might know, Jack Davies, was a former representative, law school professor. He participated on that drafting committee. I think he participated on the study committee as well. And he is the one who's sort of working with the bringing that forward. Now, with respect to that act, we are certainly looking at, there were many stakeholders who were involved in the drafting of that act. Everybody from, I know the Southern Poverty Law Center was involved because I sat at a dinner with them once about it. So there were many different stakeholders who participated in that act. And it's interesting because it has a lot of different people, like people who are in the bail business aren't that excited about it, where others are. So there was a lot of stakeholder input in that act. And as we move forward with it here, of course, we'll put together stakeholders that are interested in the passage of that act.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Next, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That kind of leads into the question I had, and particularly around that bail piece. That's something that's important to me as well. In terms of diversity with the members in your group, how are you all working on that to ensure that? I know these are lifetime appointments. And I know that in the video presentation you gave, there was a mention of diversity. So I'm just wondering if you have any numbers in terms of what the demographics look like now, and also, if not, how are you working to ensure more diversity to make sure those voices are being a part of the conversations?
Commissioner Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually technically can count as a diverse member of the commission only by the fact that I'm not old. So the commission is kind of a hard thing to say. As a state level, I joined the commission in 2016. We do not have openings that happen very often. When my slot opened, I took over for Jean Henning, who was just an honored member of our profession, who passed on. When my slot was filled, we needed a business law lawyer and preferably someone who might be non-white male. And so I get to be that. I would say Dean Jenkins is a man of color. And we were very intentional when we looked at who we would fill the next commission slot with to make sure we're always looking for diversity as new openings happen. The problem with the commission itself, as I said, there are many members who have served for a very long time. And at the time they started their service, the profession wasn't that diverse. So there's a longstanding issue to try to even get that profession more diverse. And since you have to be a licensed lawyer, we're always looking for that diversity. There is an effort. There's a committee of the ULC that's looking at diversity. We're doing better with women. So we've certainly gotten better with women, but women have been part of the profession longer and been able to achieve higher judges and what have you in the profession longer than other people of color have. So it's an effort that everyone's always making. We strive hard, and I think we really strive hard on our stakeholder committees and our other people that work on our drafting committees to make sure there's a diverse voice there, even if it's not among the commissioners themselves.
Representative Frazier, any follow-up?
Just thank you for sharing that. But I will say I shared the same kind of enthusiasm to know that Rep. Moeller did in terms of whether Mr. Tennyson was the Tennyson. So glad to know that.
Commissioner Tennyson.
Madam Chair, in terms of diversity, it's a challenge for the conference because every state determines how they appoint their commissioners and who they appoint. So as a conference, we don't really have any control over that. It's up to the states because they're the ones who do it. So we're conscious of it here and of the appointed commissioners right now. We have, as you mentioned, Dean Jenkins and two women are the appointed members. Some of us are just old and been around a long time.
Yep. Thank you, Commissioner Tennyson. And I will note though that bar is pretty low to be counted towards actual diversity. And what I sort of hear is that if the lifetime appointments are a problem, then that's something that maybe the states need to look at. Because if we're waiting until all the folks who were at the top of their game in the 60s, and we're waiting until that diversity, moves along the line. I mean, we're still looking decades out to actually having a commission that reflects the reality of our country and our state. So really good question. Thank you, Representative Frazier. And final question from Representative Scott, because then we do have one more presentation today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very quick since we have Bob Tennyson here, and I know this isn't Bob Tennyson Day, but I'm just very thankful for the Tennyson warning, and it's so practical and used so often, especially now with the sharing of people's data. But I'm curious if that's a uniform law across states now.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott.
Go ahead, Commissioner Tennyson.
No, it's not. That was part of the one of the first privacy acts in the country we passed in 1974. And I didn't name it as, what the act requires is that people be told why they asked for the information, what it'll be used for. And, when they were trying to, when Don Yemmerling was the administrator of that in the Department of Administration, he's trying to figure out what to call it and how to give it. So he's thinking of Miranda warning. So he thought, well, the Tennyson warning. And so some people are wondering where the criminal law case is, the Tennyson warning came from, but it didn't come from a criminal law case. It came from the Department of Administration. So to me, it's kind of
any follow-up reference.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Tennyson, for that. And it should be a uniform law. Maybe it's called other things in other states, but that should be a uniform law, in my opinion. So that's your next project.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Scott. And I will say that the Department of Administration does have a good link on their page explaining what the Tennyson warning is and what it does. So, Rachel, I'm going to ask you to send that out when you send out the other materials. So the non-attorneys can maybe be just as excited about having Bob Tennyson give us some testimony in our committee. And with that, I thank all the commissioners for your time. The legal nerds here, this was, you know, the exciting for us, I guess. So thank you very much. And we will move on to our last presentation, which is the Board of Judicial Standards. I think Judge Sipkins maybe is presenting. Whoever's presenting, if you could introduce yourselves. You know, I will just note in real life, we would have a table and someone would walk up to the table and I could tell exactly who it is who's going to start the presentation. But I can't tell via Zoom who that is. So if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, it looks like maybe it's Sarah Boshins, the staff attorney, but please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, good morning, everybody. Tom Sipkins is on the meeting.
Can you hear me? I can see myself.
All right, we can hear you, Judge Sipkins. Please introduce yourselves and the organization that you're with, and then go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you. I can tell you that 2 years ago, we presented to you in person, and much prefer that and hope that it will be again soon as well. My name is Tom Sipkins. I am the Executive Secretary of the Board on Judicial Standards. I've been in this role for a little over 3 years now. Before that, I was a judge in Hennepin County, and before being a judge in Hennepin, I was a lawyer for way too many years. Like I said, I've been with the board since November of 2017. A little history about the board. The board was created by the legislature in 1971. 1972, there was a constitutional amendment to the state constitution creating the board specifically. And in 2009, the board adopted what was called the Model Code of Judicial Ethics. We had four canons under that code in general. The first canon is about independence, integrity, and impartiality. The second canon is about judicial duties. Third canon is about judicial extrajudicial duties. And the fourth canon is about political activities. I do have two staff. Sarah is a fantastic lawyer. She works 3 days a week. Two of those days she works remotely. I have John Fuller, who's been with the board for longer than either of us. He is our jack of all trades. John is our budget person, our techie, our human resources person, our facilities person. He pretty much runs the show. We have a full budget of something less than $400,000 a year, and that's been fairly steady since I've been on the board. The board is comprised of 10 persons. We have four judges, one Court of Appeals judge, Louise Bjorkman, three district court judges, Judge Ellen Maas from Washington County in the 10th Judicial District, Sharia Escalani. Judge Escalani is from Hennepin County and is a former colleague of mine. And Judge Theresa Neal was recently appointed to the board from Duluth. She's a St. Louis County judge. We have two lawyers. Our chairperson is Cindy Telstead. She's a lawyer from Winona. And Tim O'Brien, who some of you may know, is a longtime lawyer from Minneapolis, the law firm of Fagree and Benson. We have four non-judge, non-lawyer members. Carol Cummins is a former law firm administrator. Gerald Kaplan is a licensed psychologist. Unfortunately, Jerry is leaving us after his two four-year terms, and so we're looking for similar replacements. He's been a valuable member for us. Debbie Toberman is from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual. And last but not least is Nia Vang. Nia is an employee of the city of St. Paul. So the last, actually the last year and a half, Governor Walz has appointed five of our 10 members. My experience with the board so far has been extremely positive. It's been a great board. They're good listeners. They're fair. When they think the discipline is necessary, they administer discipline to judges. My roles, education. I've spoken with Sarah on some occasions to all 10 judicial district judges. We have spoken at Madden's to judicial conferences. I've done new judge trainings with Judge David Knudsen from Dakota County. And we have spoken to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, for example, and we continue to try to do education to judges on all aspects of judicial conduct and ethics. Sarah and I also issue a substantial number of informal advisory opinions. Judges call us, judges email us, and ask us questions about whether or not they can or cannot do certain things. And I think even during the pandemic, the year 2000, we probably issued somewhere in the range of 150 plus informal advisory opinions to judges throughout the state. And that's at every level, including the Minnesota Supreme Court. You know, our primary function, of course, is to receive and investigate complaints of judicial misconduct. Judicial misconduct in the area of ethics, not in terms of the correctness of a legal decision. The board has resources. We have an online website that's fairly substantial. There is a very long, maybe 200-page document that Bill Wernz prepared, a former board member, which outlines all kinds of things involving judicial ethics. And Sarah has kept that up to date since Bill left the board a few years ago. We've also given seminars on campaign and judicial ethics in politics to judges and judicial candidates in the years in which there are elections. The board is a member of the National Center for State Courts. Sarah and I are members of the Association for Judicial Counsel, and we have in the past attended meetings. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to do that, and we haven't even had any real Zoom meetings with those folks as well. Let me give you an outline, basically, of the board's process. About 95% of the complaints we receive are received from various and sundry different kinds of people. They come from a lot of self-represented folks. They come to a lesser number from lawyers. Other judges report judges. There are some self-reports from judges as well. Many of those complaints come from family court. Many come from juvenile court. Fewer come from the criminal courts, and even fewer come from civil litigation type cases. We do occasionally open files ourselves as a result of statements or dicta made in decisions by either the Minnesota Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. If there is a comment about the judge's ethical conduct in those cases, we always open a file and start an investigation. Last year, I believe the board received about 180 complaints. I will tell you that we, Sarah and I, take a look at each of the complaints and we make a decision whether we have a reasonable basis to believe that there has been a violation of the code. If we believe that we have that reasonable basis to believe, we will forward the complaint to the board with a recommendation that the board authorize us to do a full investigation of the complaint. If the board does that, we will send the complaint to the judge, ask the judge to respond to the complaint, perhaps sending us documents, maybe things from the file, video, audio, so on and so forth, transcripts, and we will investigate, we'll talk to witnesses and so forth. If we do not think that we have a reasonable basis to believe a complaint, we will summarily dismiss the complaint. We are a board of limited jurisdiction. We don't have jurisdiction over lawyer misconduct. We don't have jurisdiction over probation officers, guardians ad litem, court officials, and so forth. There are occasions when a judge will be held responsible for the actions of her or his law clerks, for example. We've had that in the last year or so. We probably summarily dismissed, I'm going to say, 75% of the complaints that we received in 2020. And that is because we are a board of limited jurisdiction. The complaint process remains confidential until and unless the board authorizes us to do an investigation. So a judge, for example, may not ever know that he or she is the subject of a complaint. I will tell you on a personal experience that when I started this job, I asked my predecessor, Tom Vassily, whether or not anybody had ever complained about me as a judge. And the answer was yes, but the complaint was summarily dismissed. The most important part of this process for me is for judges to understand, you know, what it is that people are concerned about. You know, and I would say, to be honest with you, that the examples of complaints that we get come in the following areas primarily. Demeanor. The demeanor in the courtroom is something that is complained about very often by complainants. Disqualification issues are quite often parts of complaints. I would say ex parte communications are often parts of complaints. More often lately, of course, we're having issues regarding social media and independent investigations outside of the record. And those are the kinds of things that we are concerned with. There's a lot of line drawing that goes on in terms of what level of discipline, if any, should be assessed against a particular judge and so forth. So I think with that, I will turn this over to Sarah to continue and educate you about discipline and the board's process. Sarah?
And actually, Sarah, we'll take a question real quick from Representative Moeller. We've got 8 minutes of committee time left. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Judge, I have a question about something you said about looking at maybe cases where there case law where there might be a reference to something perhaps unethical done by a judge, and that you would open an investigation based on that. And as you know, judges are given much discretion, and it's not uncommon for judges to make an error or a mistake in the course of a proceeding and perhaps even abuse their discretion. And is an abuse of discretion something that leads you to open investigation, or is there a higher bar than that?
Judge Sipkins.
I think the answer to that is we're not the Court of Appeals. And probably will be a higher standard than an alleged abuse of discretion. We need to take a look at the code itself. If a judge makes an error of law, applies facts incorrectly, and so forth, unless there is a pattern of misconduct in that respect by a judge, we will normally not go there, and we will normally dismiss that kind of complaint.
Follow-up, Vice Chair Moeller? All right. Go ahead, and Ms. Beauchamps, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your part of the presentation.
No one ever pronounces her name right. Even more often, it's mispronounced than my name, which is difficult.
Sarah? Well, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having us. I'm Sarah Beauchamps. If you see my name spelled, it's just impossible to pronounce it correctly. So Beauchamps. I'm an attorney for the board. I've been with the board for about 6 years now. Before that, I was at the Attorney General's office, and I've also clerked for a district court judge in the past. So Tom asked me to talk a little bit about the tools the board has after it's completed an investigation. And I just actually wanted to mention that I apologize for this green screen. I'm not necessarily a fan of Kermit the Frog, but it's a little bit of evidence that we need to upgrade our computers. So the tools that the board has after an investigation, Tom mentioned, our most common type of complaint
usually deals with demeanor. We get a lot of complaints where a litigant says the judge wasn't fair, the judge didn't listen to me, the judge was rude to me, the judge yelled at me. In that type of case, we would often ask if there were attorneys involved in the case, we might interview those attorneys. We could also have the authority to get the transcripts and the audio of a hearing. So we would look at all of that evidence, and if that evidence doesn't show any sort of misconduct by the judge, that would be a clear dismissal. The board also has the authority to issue a letter of caution. So a dismissal would be where there's no reasonable cause to believe that the judge committed misconduct. However, if there were some concerns, if the judge had a slight demeanor issue, wasn't able to control the courtroom, but it wasn't necessarily a violation of the code, the board could issue a letter of caution, which is a dismissal, but the letter could advise the judge regarding future conduct. The board does issue a number of letters of caution every year. A recent example would be that there was an allegation of a judge writing a letter of recommendation that it was on behalf of a police chief, and the allegation was that the judge abused the prestige of judicial office. It was an interesting complaint. The letter had been written 4 years prior to the complaint even coming in. And in response, the judge did recognize that the contents, the tone of the letter didn't necessarily comply with the code, but it wasn't a clear violation. The board is able to write a letter of caution advising the judge to be more careful, more judicious in the use of his or her words in writing such letters. The board has the authority to issue a private admonition after an investigation. A private admonition is a non-public sanction for misconduct of an isolated, a non-serious offense. An example of that from a recent case is a judge issued an order in which he had made a negative statement about a person's character. It wasn't necessary for the final determination of the case. The statement related to a matter affecting the judge's personal interests. It wasn't really related to the case. And the board did find that the judge violated the prestige of judicial office. The board also has the authority to issue a deferred disposition agreement. This is, it's more of like a probationary matter. The judge can agree to undergo treatment, participate in educational programs, take other corrective actions. And then after the judge complies with the agreement for a year, 2 years, it depends on the situation, the board could then issue a private admonition. Recently, the board and the judge entered into a deferred disposition agreement because a board investigation showed that a judge had yelled at her clerk, and the reason for the judge's temper really wasn't justified by the clerk's minor errors. So the board did find a violation that the judge was not promoting confidence in the judiciary. There is a demeanor issue with that. The judge agreed to consult with a judicial mentor, so another judge. The judge is receiving therapeutic treatment as well, and has agreed to other conditions. If this judge is successful for 2 years, then the judge will receive an admonition. Public reprimands, the board does have a authority to issue a public reprimand, and that is for serious misconduct. Most recently, the board issued a public reprimand for a judge who had failed to supervise her staff and engaged in communications with her staff during hearings about the hearings before them that were really inappropriate. So you could go to the board's website and see all of the details of that. We do include summaries of the private admonitions, many of the letters of caution on the board's website as an educational tool for the public and for judges to see what the board's looking at, what the board's concerns are, and hopefully avoid such conduct. If the board and the judge are not able to agree on a sanction, the board also has the authority to issue a formal complaint. The Supreme Court then appoints a 3-judge panel to review the the board's case. The judge has opportunity to put on a case as well. The board must prove its case by clear and convincing evidence in that situation. The panel makes a recommendation, which is then reviewed by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has the authority to issue the final discipline in that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bessons. It is 9:59. I know Representative Johnson had his hand up, but we cannot go past 10 o'clock. So Representative Johnson, and it's now 10 o'clock. So Representative Johnson, if you could reach out to Ms. Bessons or Judge Sipkins with your question, I'd really appreciate that. I'm sorry we ran out of time. I wanted to get in all those other questions earlier in the presentations today. So
that's unfortunate because this is something the public needs to know about.
All right. Representative Johnson, Ms. Bessons, is this a question for Ms. Bessons or for Judge Sipkins?
Judge Sipkins.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Judge Sipkins, we'll give you one more minute. I know that House TV won't be happy with us, but Judge Sipkins, would you be able to Zoom in with us next Tuesday morning for some follow-up?
We are making a presentation to the Senate Judiciary Committee next week. I'm not sure if it's morning or afternoon, but if Representative Johnson wants to call me on the phone, I can give him my phone number right now and he can call me when this meeting is over.
Okay. We're going to have to get adjourned. Representative Johnson, we'll make sure that that information, whatever it is, gets before the public. If it's possible, we'll have Judge Sipkins come back and join us for a couple minutes. It's just the reality of our current situation with the video feed. So thank you, everybody, for your time.
That's unfortunate about the way this is set up. So it's tough right now because
Representative Johnson, we need to adjourn.
And it's the circumstances. I understand.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. We are adjourned.